The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
So I decided that the one thing that these wonderful panels lack, they don't lack talent, they don't lack spirit, they don't lack intelligence, they lack titles. And so this panel has now been christened. This panel is called Embodied Discriminations, and I'll come back to that later on. But first, it's my pleasure to introduce the first of the three wonderful speakers who you're going to hear from today, and that's Rebecca Tushnet from our crosstown rival at Georgetown. Which is very well represented, it has to be said, here today. Thanks very much to the Georgetown contingent for turning out in numbers. And Rebecca, in the relatively few years that she has been a presence in the intellectual property teaching and scholarship scene, has really begun to make for herself not one place, but several places, not all of which I can describe in limited time. But I do want to note in particular that through a series of publications and a great deal of speaking and active participation in the civil society, Rebecca has really become one of the most important and most widely listened to critics of the general situation as it now prevails under our copyright law with respect to the doctrine of fair use. And in particular, she has developed what I think is a very powerful and important critique of some of the most recent trends and tendencies in that doctrine, including its sometimes, it would seem, obsessive concentration on this mysterious thing we call transformativeness. And so one way of understanding a part of the paper that Rebecca is going to give for us today is, I think, as a continuation of that important project. So it's a delight to welcome Rebecca Tushnet.
Thank you. I'm not sure I can live up to that. I got to give you a warning about this presentation. It does contain doll nudity. But it starts somewhere else. So Wednesday morning, as I was putting off preparing for this conference, I refreshed my newsreader and found that Professor Patry had posted an entry on fair use in the women of the University of Chicago. And he was talking about collegecuteness.com. And this is the creation of a couple of undergrads at the University of Chicago who sampled the Facebook for 10 colleges, posted pictures of 35 women from each college on hotornot.com, and analyzed the results. So there's college cuteness up on the left, the Facebook down on the left, that's the you post a picture that sort of tells people about yourself. That's hot or not. You can kind of see at the bottom the link that allows you to share her with a friend. And people rate the pictures, and supposedly you're only supposed to upload these pictures if you are authorized to do so. They weren't, but they did. And as a result of this study, they determined that, as hypothesized, women at the University of Chicago were less attractive than women at the other colleges. So Patry says, well, is this a fair use? He says, it seems to me to be a classic fair use. And I agree, but for different reasons than he thinks. As far as I can tell, a classic fair use is in fact one that comments on a woman's body. And indeed, Professor Patry couldn't resist his own dig at the women whose pictures had been appropriated. He says, the fourth factor, market harm, clearly would favor the reuse, because what third parties would want to buy these pictures? I mean, the study shows the women are not attractive. So what I want to point out is sort of beyond the obvious ickiness of that is that Hatchery's joke distracted him from actual analysis of the fourth factor, because as somebody quickly pointed out in the comments to the post, the women at the University of Chicago weren't the only ones whose pictures had been appropriated. Right? The really hot women at the other colleges had also had their pictures appropriated, and by his own logic, they'd suffered market harm. And this is what women's bodies do in law generally. They distract, they take center stage, right, already an embodied metaphor, they disrupt logic. That's what makes it easy to associate women's bodies with parody and transformative use. It's parody is also disruptive, carnivalesque, chaotic. So it's natural to see parody in the mockery of a woman's body. And I want to give some examples. So this is the cover of As Clean As They Want to Be, the Two Live Crew album. You can see the bar over the women's buttocks that shows you that this is the clean version. The nasty version didn't have that bar. Whether that makes it any better, I don't know. So this is the song that it gets to be possibly a fair use as a result of camp. Of course, tears down, right? And it exposes it, you know, in this case we have the bar, but in general, parody sort of rips off the pretty image on top to show you the seamy underbelly. And sure enough, it's about the ugly woman underneath the pretty woman. This isn't unique. This is a great case. Annie Leibovitz photographed Demi Moore, and then a movie studio commissioned a photograph that would put Leslie Nielsen's face on the body of a pregnant woman. And a couple things. In keeping with this morning's panel, I want to point out there's some invisible work going on in the court's opinion, which said that this was a fair use. They hired a pregnant woman to be the body model, and they digitally manipulated her body, which doesn't show up in the opinion at all, except to say that the studio superimposed a photograph of Leslie Nielsen's face on the woman's body, which, of course, they didn't superimpose a photograph on her body. They superimposed a photograph on the photograph of her. But already, in the opinion, there's this incredible slippage between the woman and the work, at the same time as the woman is, you know, completely invisible, effaced, which I find fascinating. And the court says that you could find in this a criticism of the pretentiousness of the original, the model Demi Moore and the photographer Annie Leibovitz took themselves too seriously when they shot that picture, according to Paramount. And also, the court says, it mocks the idea that the pregnant female body is beautiful. Instead, it is ridiculous. Right. And later, just want to point out, Moore's then-husband apparently took the same stance, which you might also find interesting. One more, actually two more. Dungeon Barbie. Also a fair use, and a fair use a pro se defendant who didn't even bother to really respond to Mattel's complaint. Nonetheless, the court goes to great efforts to say, and I should say I don't disagree with this, that this is transformative fair use. There is no line of S&M Barbie. So Mattel is not being harmed by this, and something about harmed directly in its in the market for its works. And there's the commentary here on Barbie as sexual object, right? by giving her nipples, exposing the fact that she is a sexual object. Likewise, this is Food Chain Barbie, put in domestic context and put at risk from household appliances. You criticize Barbie, it turns out, by sexing her up, by ripping her clothes off to show the real doll underneath. You show the problems that were there all along. And that's what transformative use is about, in particular the parody satire division. Something is parody if it picks up on what was always part of the original. It's satire if it just uses the original and doesn't comment on it for its own purposes. And this, it turns out, is parody or is transformative because merely putting Barbie in these contexts turns out to be commentary on what she was all along. Right? And if you hear a little Catherine MacKinnon on pornography in there, that's not accidental. So sex, in particular, isn't so much added as revealed as a characteristic of the female body in transformative use. And that's what makes it transformative. Violence or subtler commentary often aren't. Whoops. And one of these things is not like the others. Right? Barbie with milk being poured on her in a very sexually suggestive way is transformative fair use. The cat not in the hat about a murder is not. The big one parodying corporate America and Men in Black is not. I want to be clear. I'm not saying that mocking women shouldn't be fair use. Rather, what I want to do is call attention to a pattern in the case law. It's not surprising that copyright law is subject to the biases that pervade culture. It would only be surprising if copyright escaped them. I think this pattern isn't good enough. And the way I would solve this problem is having more changes count as fair use rather than requiring you to find that there's something already inherent in Barbie that justifies tearing her up, sexualizing her, threatening her. Therefore, it's one more reason I think we should be more willing to accept claims about commentary that happens in other ways that isn't just about ripping the clothes off the woman or the doll. A couple of other things that I want to note about fair use analysis, because I think that part was easy, right? I mean, if you look at the cases, there are all these naked women, something's going on there. But it turns out fair use has some gendered implications in other ways. And one thing I found particularly interesting in the Wind Done Gone case is the discussion of the market for authorized uses by the 11th Circuit. So it turns out that the Wind Done Gone includes discussion and practice of miscegenation and homosexuality. And the 11th Circuit, in deciding that there was probably a fair use claim, says, well, the state is violently opposed to letting any authorized derivative works include a miscegenation or homosexuality. Therefore, there's no harm to the state's legitimate markets. That is to say that the market for gay and race-mixing themed works is a separate market and one that the state isn't going to enter. Compare this to the imaginary version of Gone with the Wind set in outer space. 200 years from now. There is no chance that the 11th Circuit would have said the estate has no interest in science fiction versions, therefore this isn't harming the legitimate derivative market. And so one of these markets, the sci-fi market, is the copyright owners, and one isn't. But as it turns out, there is in fact a market for gay-themed books. It exists. It's legitimate. One could enter it. There's a judgment being made here that the owner of a work in the sort of legitimate mainstream market won't enter it. Likewise, there is a market for sexually explicit works, but the judgment that gets made in these fair use cases is, well, the copyright owner won't enter it. But there are plenty of copyright owners in that market. I mean, everybody's a copyright owner. And I also want to point out, movie companies routinely enter both markets. With their family-friendly edits and then the unrated DVD versions of the same movies that you can get separately. There's clearly a market for Brokeback Mountain. So what makes Brokeback Top Gun, you know, which you may have seen floating around in one of these other parodies, what makes that a use presumptively outside the copyright owner's control? What's going on, I think, is that the social meaning of sexuality is being used to divide copyright owners in sexually explicit markets from those in the mainstream market, at least for purposes of fair use analysis. It doesn't necessarily track actual practices, because you will find people existing in both markets. You'll certainly find conglomerates existing in both markets, conglomerates that would do cross-licensing in appropriate circumstances. But we'll pretend that they don't, so that we can, decide that our ideal description of fair use, which is, you know, it's okay to do parodies because that's pro-free speech and so on, also corresponds with the reality on the ground, which is there won't be any market harm. You know, we don't have to trade off anything. We're not really losing anything because no copyright owner, no legitimate copyright owner would ever want to go there in the first place. Now, that's not true. And we should admit it, I think. And there's another case worth mentioning, Kane versus Comedy Productions, which was an interesting case in this regard because Sandy Kane does a public access TV show. She's a former stripper. I don't know exactly what's former about her. Apparently, she performs, you know, wearing very little in the way of clothing, and she sings sexually suggestive songs and so on. And the comedy, The Daily Show, which I presume many of you know and love, did this thing with her as part of the worst of what public TV has to offer. And she sued, and she said, look, I am willing to license for parody. And in fact, I have licensed. So give me my money, right? Because I have disproved the theory of the fourth factor. And the court said, no, that would cause too many problems with circularity, which is totally true, but not something that courts admit in any other context. And again, I think the separation, the social separation of sex, sexually explicit from non-sexually explicit, is the only thing that can explain this. Nearly finally, because I'm going to say one thing about further investigations are needed, but I want to talk a little bit about the gendered implications of the relevance of commercial use. So in Campbell, Justice Souter quotes the statement, no man but a blockhead ever wrote except for money. And he does this to say that parodies that are done for profit can still be fair uses, right? We shouldn't discriminate against them, which I think is fine, except he does that by denigrating non-commercial use and treating it as if it were such a minor and ridiculous, blockheaded part of the world of speech that it can safely be ignored. And I think this is a mistake. Non-commercial production, according to this theory, women's work, is stupid. It's blockheaded. And, of course, I immediately, when I was thinking about this, thought about my work on women who write fan fiction for, and they distribute it for free on the internet. Interestingly enough, it's often about men's bodies. And there are lots of reasons for that. But it's, in many ways, it fits into the standard fair use factors and probably would, as a matter of simple equality, get called fair use in a culture that says sexualization of the non-explicit is inherently transformative. But I gotta wonder, isn't there more out there? I mean, can't we do better than this formal equality? And so what I would like to call for is further thoughts about what a sort of dominance theory of intellectual property would look like. And finally, part of that would be investigating the relevance of the public-private distinction in copyright. Because increasingly in transformative use cases, we're actually seeing the second factor, the nature of the work, being used as a sword for the fair user. That is, the idea is this was published and therefore it receives less protection, which is a big change from in earlier years when it was really, is this a factual work or is it a fictional work? And if it's fictional, there's less leeway for fair use. Now, if it's fictional but published, courts often say that weighs at least slightly in favor of the transformative user. And this is something about, you know, these when combined with the topic of sex, it's about a public woman being available for anyone to use, as opposed to privacy where, you know, there is one owner. And you can look at the results in the unpublished works cases. It turns out, you know, Gerald Ford and J.D. Salinger get to keep their works private. And I don't think it's accidental that those are texts, not images as well. So that is where I will leave you. Thank you very much. Do I have time to play a little bit of a clip?
Of course.
Okay, so I'll only do this if it seems relevant. How many of you guys know the song Stacy's Mom? Okay, so consider what you think about whether this is this would have an effect on the market for legitimate derivative works. Let's see if I hope I can make it play. Come on. Well, I have a song here called Stacy's Dad, and it's sung by a guy about his crush on Stacy's dad. I think it actually fits into the exact same thing as the Gone with the Wind thing. So if I could make it play, I would, but I can't. Thank you.
Thank you, Rebecca. Our next presenter is Eileen Kane, who comes to Legal Academia by way of a PhD background in molecular biology and a great deal of significant work in that field, as well as in patent and science-related practice. She is now at Penn State Dickinson, and she's teaching there a very wide range, an impressively wide range, of IP and law technology courses. And she's emerging as a powerful critic of important contemporary patent developments, including the general subject of over-patenting. I'm personally looking forward very much to her forthcoming article on patent ineligibility, maintaining a scientific public domain. So with that,
thank you,
Eileen Kane.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this presentation. I don't have a PowerPoint. I will try to make my talk as followable as I can without the visuals. But what I'd like to do is just up front say why I got interested in this topic and what I was hoping to do with the paper. The topic I'm addressing is to take a specific women's health issue and look very specifically and try to track the intellectual property landscape of a particular women's health issue, and in this case I've chosen breast cancer. And I'm doing this obviously because I'm a woman, I'm interested in this as a health issue. I'm also interested in identifying when and where intellectual property, and in this case, of course, it's going to be specifically patents, when and where patents are sort of a help or a hindrance, a plus or a minus. I don't have some neat conclusion, all patents are bad and, you know, we don't have a cure for breast cancer because we have patents. I don't have a conclusion that says that patents have consistently helped advance the field of breast cancer research. But the framework I chose to try to illustrate the story here is to take sort of a historical approach and identify four molecules. That illustrate sort of the thinking in the breast cancer research field, and then discuss the intellectual property claims and conflicts that have attended to each one. Now, the women's health movement, I'm not going to give a lot of background on the women's health movement and the activism in the women's health movement, but certainly an increase in interest in breast cancer and accomplishing more research and treatment and prevention and diagnosis of breast cancer is certainly a logical outgrowth of the women's health movement. The women's health movement, of course, really goes back now certainly to the 70s, late 60s and 70s, starting with publication of books like Our Bodies, Ourselves, and the rise of different groups that, you know, started out with sort of a self-help model of women helping each other learn more about women's health, women's bodies, feminist self-help practices. Then emerging into probably more organized, somewhat more professionalized, credentialized apparatus where you see groups like the Women's Medical Association and public advocacy groups like the National Women's Health Network. And then specific now, we have certainly specific breast cancer advocacy groups such as the National Association, the National Organization of Breast Cancer Organizations, Breast Cancer Action. There are a number of books that are written on the history of the breast cancer advocacy field, and of course that's a very complicated political landscape. Now, while the interest in breast cancer in the last 10 or 15 years, which is really where you can trace an increase in sort of addressing the problem of breast cancer, and that's illustrated by a number of metrics. One is just, you know, simple press coverage and sort of public awareness of the issue. Certainly, I think most historians of breast cancer advocacy and women's health issues would certainly trace the rise of breast cancer advocacy and that kind of patient advocacy development to be partly inspired in the early 90s by the success, or at least the increasing organization of the AIDS community, that is a very powerful and effective patient advocacy movement certainly inspired women to say, gee, I want some of those same tactics of organization, lobbying, awareness, recruitment of high-profile public figures. Would that help us in terms of increasing the visibility of this as a women's health issue? And, of course, in a parallel manner, getting more money to work on research. Now, breast cancer is not an insignificant women's health issue. Each year, about 200,000 women are diagnosed with breast cancer. Each year, about 45,000 women do die of breast cancer. So it's a significant women's health issue. Of course, it doesn't surpass heart disease, which is still the leading killer of women, but it's a significant health issue for women. And it's gender-specific largely, even though there's a very tiny proportion of men that can and do get breast cancer. So what I've chosen to do then is to take these molecules, and let me see if I can kind of walk us through, you know, sort of each actor in this sort of four-part play and sort of talk about what the molecule is, what the thought was, what the field was trying to do with the development of a certain compound, and where patents played a role or didn't play a role. The first one I've chosen is Taxol, which is one of the standard chemotherapy drugs. It's been around for a very long time. It really goes back, Taxol goes back to 60s, 70s. Basically, it was observed in the lab that Taxol arrests the division of cells. It causes cells to stop dividing. That's perfect for a drug that would affect the unchecked growth that you see in cancer. Now, Taxol was discovered, actually, Taxol was identified in a federal laboratory under the auspices of the National Cancer Institute. Back in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, here was this very interesting observation at the NCI, the National Cancer Institute, very powerful compound. There actually is a woman scientist, Susan Horowitz, up at Einstein College of Medicine, who's really the leading scientist who illustrated how Taxol works. So it was a very promising compound. The problem is the federal government's not in the business of bringing drugs to the marketplace. How could we get this compound into the marketplace? That's not what the federal government does. Well, we've had a series of laws enacted starting in 1980, coming again 1986, Stevenson-Widler Act, the Federal Technology Transfer Act, that have allowed federal laboratories to enter into license agreement with private industry. In other words, find a private partner, get the private partner on board to try to get the compound into the marketplace. This is what happened with Taxol. NIH struck an agreement with Bristol-Myers Squibb, Bristol-Myers Squibb, I was just going to call it BMS for short, but probably the same number of syllables, struck an agreement with, call it BMS, to bring the compound to market and signed what's called a CRADA, which some of you may have heard of, a Cooperative Research and Development Agreement, essentially a contract. Gave BMS the exclusive rights to use all the data from clinical trials that the NIH had initiated and said, hey, take this data, go to the FDA, get approval to bring this to market, which is what BMS did. BMS got an approval from the FDA to put Taxol on the market in 1992. Now, interesting with Taxol, and here's where, you know, one of the patent dimensions comes in. Taxol was not patentable, been in the public domain too long, so it was not possible for anybody to get a patent on that actual molecule. So when BMS shows up at the FDA, what they do get is 5 years of market exclusivity as the first to file for drug approval on that drug. So theoretically, in the theoretical scheme of things, BMS's market exclusivity would go for about 5 years, and around 1997 or so, we'd start to see generic entry into the marketplace. What happened then is as 1997 approaches, or the mid-90s, BMS, you know, of course, like most drug manufacturers with blockbuster drugs, which Taxol turned out to be, it turned out to generate, at its heyday for BMS, $1 billion in sales per year. Of course, BMS started to panic as they realized they were losing the ability to control the market. And so what they did starting and got around 1997 was a series of patents. They went and got patents. You can say, well, what patents did they get? They got patents on methods of using Taxol, methods to treat it here, treat it there, this dosage, whatever. Using those patents then allowed BMS then now to have sort of a patent stance in the marketplace. And that's significant because you've got a lot of generic companies waiting in the wings, you know, counting down to 1997 where they anticipate jumping into the market. As a result of BMS getting these patents, they were then able to sort of enlist the services and the procedures of what's called the Hatch-Waxman Act, which is a very complicated statute in food and drug law, designed to accelerate generic entry into the marketplace. But there's sort of, you know, there's kind of goodies for everybody in Hatch-Waxman. There's some things for the brand name manufacturer. There's some goodies for the generic. In this case, once BMS had patents in 1997, if a generic company wanted to enter the marketplace, which a lot of them did, by law, BMS was allowed to, was granted an automatic 30-month stay of any generic application under Hatch-Waxman. So there you're already pushing it back to 1999, 2000. Now you can say, well, is this illegal? Well, it wasn't illegal per se. The problem was that the patents that BMS had gotten were really quite shaky, quite weak, ultimately found invalid. So in other words, they were gotten, they were obtained, but as a lot of you, some of you may know, patents can be obtained from the patent office. That doesn't mean upon close inspection that they really should have been granted, or perhaps cannot be declared invalid later on. Anyway, BMS was able to use these patents to certainly buy itself another 2 or 3 years. After 2 or 3 years, they panicked again because theirs goes the 30-month stay, and so they then entered into a contract with a generic company that had a patent and basically was trying to get this next patent to sort of do that same work of staving off the generic entrance into the marketplace. Ultimately, now this was getting the attention of a lot of people, including the Federal Trade Commission, which did file an enforcement action against BMS around 2002, 2003. Ultimately, BMS's conduct with respect to this drug, with respect to other drugs in its portfolio, got the FTC attention, and they were basically, you know, brought up short by the FTC, and the allegations for all their practices using government processes to delay and forestall the development of a generic market were sort of brought up short by the FTC. In addition, the court started to look with disfavor on their ability to use these various patents to keep out the generic entrance. So Taxol is a case that illustrates sort of what some people call the gaming of the pharmaceutical marketplace, the use of generic procedures to actually delay generic competition, not accelerate it, contrary to the statute. There's another issue illustrated by Taxol, which is sort of goes back to the beginning of that drug, which is, what about a drug that was developed essentially in a federal laboratory and ultimately turned out to be a blockbuster for BMS, and then BMS even further maintained its monopoly at least till 2000. It's not till 2000 that we finally get generic entrant. That's been very unsatisfactorily resolved. The GAO has done a study of Taxol as sort of a model case of taxpayer-funded research that was essentially you know, hand it over to private industry, and, you know, just remember, we don't have a lot of time to get into health economics, but certainly the federal government ends up paying for the health care for a lot of people through Medicare, through Medicaid. The federal government then, for a lot of certainly Medicare recipients, is ending up purchasing Taxol from BMS, even though it's a drug that was developed under the auspices of NIH. There's unsatisfactory resolution there, but it's certainly a poster child for the unresolved issues over whether or not reasonable pricing, et cetera, should be enforced with respect to compounds developed through federal money. All right, drug number two. Let me just switch gears. Tamoxifen. Now, tamoxifen is the second drug I chose. It's a giant in the breast cancer field. What does it do? Well, essentially, it attacks breast cancer by understanding breast cancer as a kind of cancer that is accelerated by female hormones. Why do women, women have breasts, number one, men have breasts, and women have more breast tissue, but also female hormones are considered to play a huge role in development of breast cancer. Tamoxifen basically blocks estrogen. It's an anti-estrogen. Great candidate then for a breast cancer drug. What goes on there? Well, that has a standard chemical patent that ICI, which is a company, got in 1985 and got very legitimately and arguably would have had till around 2002. Some generic companies wanted to come into the marketplace around the late 90s and tried to invalidate the ICI patent. Interestingly, in 1992, the ICI patent was actually held invalid. But what happened is something that's now coming under very close scrutiny in a lot of quarters, which is the brand name company essentially striking a deal with the generic and saying, you know, in so many words, we don't have a great patent here, but can we strike some sort of deal with you to keep you out of them? Can we pay you enough to stay out of the marketplace, even though the patent was just declared invalid? Sometimes called a reverse payment. Long story short, this eventually got the attention of a lot of consumer groups, which is because what you start to see here is arguably some kind of collusion, some kind of conspiracy to restrain trade. This contract was challenged in antitrust suits brought by consumer groups. There were women's groups involved with this. This has now come up through the Second Circuit, which in a very sort of controversial opinion has said or endorsed the idea that basically there's nothing wrong here. Even though arguably a very good antitrust allegation, Sherman Act violations. There are some parallel cases now waiting cert, and I anticipate, I think a lot of people do, the Supreme Court will take one of these cases and try to address whether this kind of brand name generic buddy system will be allowed to continue, whether or not it violates antitrust laws. We now have a generic tamoxifen on the market. Third compound, Herceptin, is the one I chose. Herceptin represents now molecular biology entering the field of breast cancer research and scientists identifying a particular protein on the surface of breast cancer cells and deliberately designing a drug that targets that molecule. So it's an antibody against a protein that's uniquely found in breast cancer cells. Nothing wrong there. That's, you know, this is the kind of drug that we anticipate coming out of biotech medicine. Genentech is the manufacturer. Genentech has a patent on it. We've seen a couple of biotech competitors try to, you know, go after Genentech and try to assert patents that they had pretty unsuccessfully. Herceptin, I flag as probably likely to represent what would be a huge issue in patent, food and drug law, antitrust, which would be how do we get generic biotech drugs to market? We're really not there yet. You see the battles we've had over Taxol, Tamoxifen. Those are classic drugs, small chemicals. We do not have any now regulatory process really to allow the development of a generic biotech marketplace. Herceptin will certainly be a compound that will really test that because it's a drug that goes for right now about $48,000 a year. There's tremendous outcry over the price of the medicine. There was going to be a lot of pressure from women's health activists to get a generic Herceptin to market. Last one, the breast cancer genes, the BRCA1, the BRCA2. Now these don't have a lot of time to get into gene patenting, but I think people know that, you know, scientists and companies routinely file for patents on pieces of DNA, on genes, and are granted them by the patent office, which has met with, you know, a lot of academic criticism, including some things I have written. Nonetheless, here we are with two genes, and what do? Well, they identify, they offer the possibility for women to be screened to determine whether or not they're at particularly high risk of developing breast cancer. About 5 to 10% of breast cancers travel in families, and those families have very high risk. I mean, women getting this cancer in their 20s and 30s, and multiple female relatives in the family getting this. Those women and those families would like to know whether or not they're at higher risk. It allows you certainly to monitor and undertake prophylactic measures if you'd like to do that. Now, these genes were discovered in the mid-90s, discovered by academic scientists, licensed now to a biotech company called Myriad out in Salt Lake City. Myriad has effective control, and that there's been a lot written about Myriad of the breast cancer marketplace. You could say, well, isn't what that what they get to do with the patent? Yeah, that is what they get to do with the patent, but there's been concern, number one, over the pricing of the test, the lack of competition for the test, and very interestingly, and it just happened this week, even since I sent in this draft of the paper, we just have a leading group, Mary Claire King and her colleagues at University of Washington, coming out with a big study in the Journal of the American Medical Association at a big press conference on Monday, now illustrating very definitively that the Myriad tests, remember they control the whole genetic testing market for breast cancer, the Myriad tests have a lot of technical limits, and it misses a good number of cases of women who really are at high risk for breast cancer, but their test just misses that. And the problem with that is there is no other test. There is no other test possible because they are retaining the rights on the breast cancer genes. Now, I'll just end by saying that we have a slightly different climate in Europe, where the EPO allows for an opposition procedure, and we've had very somewhat successful challenges to Myriad in Europe. Some opposition, at least one opposition has knocked out one of the Myriad patents for lack of novelty. One of the other patents has been maintained in an amended form. So there's a mechanism by which the research organizations in Europe have been able to try to open up the marketplace. And remember here, we're not just talking about price and patient access. We're also talking about scientific development. I mean, there's a lot of concern that in any developing field that you have multiple scientific groups and scientists able to work on a given problem. Myriad, given its licensing structure and its unreceptivity to other commercial laboratories licensing a test and using it, has not allowed that to develop very well. And now we're really not only dealing with issues of access, but the real intellectual development of the field and the fact that we may not be identifying all the mutations that we need to, and candidates at risk are not now getting accurate testing information. And that's, of course, a deep concern because it completely frustrates the whole point of having genetic testing, which is to sort of hopefully give women kind of a plus or a minus answer. I don't know if I've gone over my time, but I'll just say in summary, there's just taking these leading compounds in the breast cancer field, and I've kind of flown through them very quickly, but you really see the very interesting conflicts between the brand name and the generic companies arising. You see the sort of in the wings, you know, soon to be dealt with development of a generic biotech industry. You certainly now see all the, you know, some of the implications of gene patenting for a real patient population. And you can, I'll just answer one question that I've been trying to think about. Do patents help or hurt breast cancer research? The answer is mixed. For compounds legitimately developed by commercial companies, et cetera, I mean, fine, go get a chemical compound, you know, fair and square. For, you know, with the actions of BMS for a compound that it didn't really develop, that it got very weak patents that allowed it just to stave off competition, their patents were really in the way. The breast cancer gene. Remember, with breast cancer testing, you're not talking about huge R&D and clinical trials to bring that to market. So you don't have that huge expenditure justifying perhaps some return on investment. Probably patents right now are somewhat in the way in terms of getting those services really to women. With Herceptin, probably there the patent has really helped bring that to market. The question is whether the patent, once it expires, will actually go away or still somewhat overshadow the development of a generic marketplace. So with that, I'd like to close, and thanks for inviting me.
Thank you.
So it's part of the sort of the common wisdom, which may well be wrong, about the American Civil War, that at the conclusion of it, Jefferson Davis tried to escape the Union encirclement of Macon, Georgia, by dressing up in hoop skirts and attempting to slip through the federal lines. And Bartow, who's going to be talking to us today, may, once the contents of this paper is known, may have to go back to South Carolina in disguise.
Yes, it is definitely in the post-tenure genre.
Yes, this is, to say the least, an inflammatory paper from that point of view.
Yes.
As you can guess, is based in South Carolina, although she has been a valued visitor in a number of other places, including here, where she's demonstrated her wonderful capacities as a classroom teacher. She's also a prodigious scholar and someone who is often first to subjects that then become matters of much more general concern and interest. So Anne's early writings, for example, on gender discrimination and legal education really laid the foundation for a whole lot of work that has very usefully come after. And Anne is also a pioneer of the subject that we are working on here today, that is the IP gender connection. I could mention many things, but I think I'll limit myself here in case you haven't read it. It's in the bibliography to mentioning the likelihood of confusion paper, which talks in a fascinating and subtle way about the gendered nature of trademark analysis. Now, today Anne is going to try out something rather different on us, and I think with that I will simply stop and sit back and take advantage with you of the presentation.
Rather I. Okay, thank you. I actually have to say, first, I'm disappointed we didn't get to hear Rebecca's clip, because if you've ever heard that Fountains of Wayne song, Stacy's mom, it goes, Stacy's mom has got it going on. And the reason I know this is my son's name is Casey, and many of his friends torment me with that song frequently. Okay. What I'm going to talk to you today about, and if you've looked at the draft is still a bit vestigial, but you won't actually see a whole lot of express gender in there yet. I'm still kind of working up to that. You'll hear a little bit of it in the talk, but I think I'll also explain as I go why the gender critique is somewhat submerged in a broader critique of what I'm calling trademarks of privilege, the naming rights in the physical public domain. And basically, the thesis of my paper is that the men who control this country will, at every opportunity, name things after themselves. And the questions I want to ask are, why are we allowing this, and what alternatives might there be, and what are some of the other considerations? Now, I hooked this all on trademark law, because that's what I do, and because trademark law is one body of law that really establishes the power of words, the power of phrases and words and as symbols and as signifiers. Consumers form impressions of goods, supposedly, and impute that impression to the trademark, right? It was a good can of soda, so now I love the Coca-Cola trademark. Or the reverse is true. You have an opinion of the mark, I like a Coca-Cola, so I will try, you know, Coke One or Coke, whatever it is, tastes like Lysol, don't try it. But the trademark may lead you to try it because you've imputed this good taste from the other cola experience you had to the marked good. When we start considering what I'm calling the physical public domain, and that would be physically owned, physically produced assets, we pretend that this trademark relationship really shouldn't have any role in how we think about things. And for one local example, here in Washington, D.C., you have the Key Bridge, right? I spent a lot of time on that Key Bridge. Some of it happy, some of it less happy when the traffic wasn't moving. So one thing I thought about was Francis Scott Key. Francis Scott Key did not build that bridge, okay? And he doesn't own that bridge. And he was named. The bridge was simply named for him, but there was still a reputational thing going on. It's not linear trademark, but there's a reputational issue because the city of Washington, D.C., or the federal governor, whoever made the decision, I don't even know, somehow somebody decided that Scott needed to be honored, and naming this bridge after him would be a good way to do it. Now, it may make people who really like the Star Spangled Banner feel better about the bridge, that it's named after Francis Scott Key. I don't know. But there are things that could happen that would make the bridge seem a little bit like a liability to the name and reputation of Francis Scott Key. For example, if there, God forbid, there were a horrible accident on that bridge, and that's the association people started making with it, or a terrorist attack or some horrible thing happened on the bridge, it might harm, well, it certainly may color our feeling about the bridge, it might also harm the societal or cultural view of Francis Scott Key. And you might ask at one level, who would care? He's kind of been dead a long time. Well, I can tell you one group of people who would care, and that would be the Key family of Columbia, South Carolina. They are related. They are direct linear descendants of Francis Scott Key. You might ask, Ann, how do you know that? And I will tell you how I know that. I know that because they've told me that at least 10 times every time I run into them, party, soccer game, whatever. Oh, by the way, they're really off. They're very, very happy about being related and very proud of being related to Francis Scott Key. But, of course, he has a much deeper cultural meaning, too, right? He wrote our national anthem. We all have an investment about how people feel about Francis Scott Key. To segue to the South for a minute, anyone have any particular association with the Edmund G. Pettus Bridge? No? Nobody knows what that? Okay. It was the scene. Go ahead, Ann. You can tell them. It was the scene of a very famous civil rights march. It was the backdrop of a hosing and dog attacking of some peaceful marchers during the civil rights in Birmingham, Alabama. And it became known, if you, the civil, very famous icon of the Civil War. And I don't know who Pettus was, but I almost kind of feel sorry for him because, you know, really a lot of people kind of invested in the civil rights movement don't have particularly good associations with the bridge, which have nothing to do with who he was as a person. Okay. The physical public domain sometimes has, sometimes is something that we actually, instead of naming after people, is the subject of corporate sponsorships or corporate naming rights. Let me just skip ahead, actually. And this is one example. This is in Columbia, South Carolina, the University of South Carolina. This is our big new stadium. This is where the game, the Fighting Gamecocks play. What do you notice about this? It says Colonial Center, right? It does not say University of South Carolina, except, see these little letters against the gray? That's where it says Home of the Carolina Gamecocks. You can barely notice it. Now, it is true that that's Cocky, our mascot, in the center there. But Colonial Center really pretty much dominates the terrain of this. And this is just an example. The Colonial Center broadcasts billboards and over the radio every time they advertise, it's a life insurance company, that they are a naming rights partner of the University of South Carolina. And basically, when they put their name on our stadium, they kind of abrogate basic trademarks principles. They do this. What comes out of it for them? What comes out of it for them is they harvest incredible amounts of goodwill, right? Because especially when we have a winning season, but even when we don't, that stadium gets packed, and everyone has a good feeling for the Gamecocks, and they attribute it to the Colonial Insurance Company. Do they own the stadium? No. The people of South Carolina own the stadium. Do they run the stadium? No. That's some company called Global Spectrum. Do they play at the stadium? No. Right? They, you know, lately maybe they would actually have a chance against our Gamecocks, but no, they don't play basketball. They're an insurance company, and what they are doing here is intentionally bleeding and blurring their trademark to get our goodwill, which is public goodwill. What I like to know about this deal, and I actually did some research on this particular deal, is what happened? We're a public university. What about transparency? What I wanted to know is how is this deal negotiated? Like, who chooses Colonial Life Insurance to name our center? Right? What were the standards? I'm not saying there weren't them. I just couldn't find out what they were. Was it the highest bidder? It's possible it was the highest bidder. I actually kind of doubt that, though, because if the rule was the highest bidder, what if the highest bidder was like Preparation H, right? We're not going there. We don't want them naming our stadium. We want some control, so there has to be some quality control over who's going to, and even, you know, it's the South. There's different mores in the South. Washington University in St. Louis is their building as the Anheuser-Busch building for their law school. Beer naming a building, of course, that's a private university, but probably wouldn't go down that well. I have no objection to beer, but I'm just telling you, if a beer company had been the top bidder, there would have been some objection. So there was something more than just money. Who made the decision? I don't even know that. Was it our legislature? Was it the university trustees? Was it the president? I have no idea, and I couldn't figure it out. What basis? How much money did they actually pay, and where does the money go? It turns out even in public universities, there's all this mysterious, there are these mysterious private foundations that control all our money that for some reason aren't subject to the Open Records Act. So I couldn't, with a fair amount of attention to this, I couldn't really find out much about this. So I really can't tell you. Okay. Other naming acts, pretty much endemic to the physical public domain, particularly but not exclusively in the university standard context. How much money for what naming honor? Right. This is one big example because this is a big stadium. This is where I park, by the way. You can see parking was not such great shape. That's not my car, though. I have a hybrid, a small Honda. But in any event, this is a big part of the transitioning of the University of South Carolina. But, I mean, there are a million naming things at every university, and the standards for how much do you pay to get a professorship or a classroom or something named for you. In the private universities, I assume there are some kind of standards, but I'm not going to worry about them. But in the public universities, you would think that there would be some standardization, right? Some standardization for how much. Because otherwise, I suspect what happens at many schools is that people get deals, right? Somebody's buddy can endow a professorship for this much money versus, you know, a complete stranger off the street gets, you know, has charge a bit more. And I think at a public university, a little transparency would be a very helpful thing. I think, you know, some sort of standards about this, which names we're going to take, and if we're not going to allow a naming, what the standard is going to be, costs and considerations, and also some unnaming issues. There are examples. After the Enron situation, some of the Enron executives had made gifts, naming gifts, and then the names were removed. Now, maybe that was because they didn't write all the checks, right? I mean, maybe you could say, okay, that's justified, but it'd be nice if there was some kind of standard, like we unname this if you don't write all the checks you were supposed to, or you know, maybe there's some way that we can characterize shaming the university, which would lead to kind of an unnaming. Public assets generally, there have been a couple of these controversies that others, law school people, you might be aware of. When the Florida Law School became named after Fred Levin, that stirred up a lot of people. Now, some people maybe just didn't like Levin, but I actually think that the larger argument wasn't really about Levin personally. It was just about the idea that you're taking a public law school and basically privatizing it in a quasi-trademark way. He's a prominent lawyer. He has a prominent law firm. It looks like he now kind of owns or says some kind of business affiliation or at least endorsement by a public law school. And you wondered also how, you know, the ramifications are for the law school, for the people at the law school, for their ability to fundraise and have good relationships with other law firms who might go up against Levin. All very complicated. This became personal when a plaintiff's lawyer in South Carolina almost considered but didn't follow through giving a huge gift to our law school, a naming gift for the law school. We came this close to being the Motley School of Law. I don't make this stuff up. His name is John Motley, and he was thinking about giving a naming gift. Still could happen. Good comedic potential there. In any event, what happens when we have these naming gifts? I mean, how does this play out for a law school? I mean, I don't want to say Levin got a free ride on the goodwill of the Florida Law School, because I assume he wrote a pretty big check, so it wasn't a free ride. But, you know, there's no quid pro quo really there. He probably gets a tax deduction. How this all thing plays out is really kind of mysterious. Okay, so this is my questions about Colonial. Now I want to talk to you a little more generally about some of the social implications, because what I've talked about so far with Levin and Motley are situations in which we have private individuals coughing up a bunch of money to get their name on public assets. But what troubles me even more is the situation in which there is no private money getting coughed up, right? There are public assets that are getting named, but it is all the public's money, that they don't actually have to pay any money for the privilege of getting their name on stuff. And I randomly picked an example. That would be Strom Thurmond. So I'm calling this section of the paper the Thurmondization of South Carolina. That's our state house. That's the Confederate flag that flies out in front of it. This is the view down Main Street walking from the law school, which is just a block from the state house, toward the state house. Guess who that is? Come on, that's Strom Thurmond. Yeah, that would be Strom Thurmond. And here we go, and up close and personal. So he very much has a presence on the state house grounds. That's our governor, our legislature, meet as the most prominent South Carolinian, bar none. That's him right in front of the state house. Now, here's a close-up of this statue. You see it says statesman, soldier, educator, and it lists all his wonderful teacher and athletic coach, blah, blah, blah. The father of it used to say four. And then scratched in five, you can see the great job. And he's used to be in birth order, Nancy Strom Jr., Juliana Paul, and then they added S.E. May in there. Now, here's something about Strom that I think is fairly well known. When he was 25 years old and a school teacher, see how
strikes as teacher at the top, he got a 14-year-old girl pregnant, and from that union came Essie May. You're a 25-year-old teacher, you get a 14-year-old girl pregnant, she has a child that you don't acknowledge for during your entire lifetime, and what does South Carolina do about it? Names the school after him. It's the Thurman High School, right? Very interesting kind of choice. Okay, in addition to this high school, there are many state and government things that are named. The state and federal government has acted many times to Thurmanize South Carolina. There is Strom Thurmond High School. You can work out at the Strom Thurmond Fitness Center. The Strom Thurmond Institute at Clemson is well funded. The Strom Thurmond Highway. There are lakes, federal buildings, the courthouses, etc., with absolutely no indication of the basis and mechanisms for the specific names. And then I have to ask you, is Thurman a trademark? How does this all work? Do you impute your feelings from Thurman to the things that are named? Do you impute your feelings about the Strom Thurmond Fitness Center, for example, it's actually a pretty beautiful, very new facility, to Strom Thurmond, and in that way sort of inculcate generations of University of South Carolina students with the idea that Thurman was a really good guy? The streets in Columbia, South Carolina, well, actually, let me back up a second, and let me have a bipartisan moment. Everything I've just said about Strom Thurmond, if you were in West Virginia, we'd be saying it about Robert Byrd, okay? And he's a Democrat. So just in fairness, Thurmond, this is a very bipartisan situation. We've Thurmanized South Carolina, and he happened to be a Republican for most of his career. We would say the same thing about Robert Byrd in West Virginia because he had the same idea. And in fact, just to give you a little example of how this whole thing works, the process generally for this sort of stuff is very diffuse, it's very opaque, and it's very hard to pin down, but periodically you get moments of scary clarity and how this whole thing works. I'm thinking about, for the paper, calling it targeted affirmative action, which I know is very loaded, but that may work for me, it may work against me, I can't decide. But you do not, even if you're Strom Thurmond, you do not sit there and wait for people to honor you. It doesn't happen. You have to affirmatively act and convince them that they need to honor you. Well, how do you do this? Well, one of the ways you do it is you're Strom Thurmond, you're 85 years old, you go, what would I like for my 85th birthday? I would like to have an enormous lake named after me. How do I make this happen? I call my buddy, Fritz Hollings, who's at that time the other senator from South Carolina, and I ask him, Fritz, would you get a lake named after me for my 85th birthday? And then Fritz Hollings gets up on the Senate floor and says, in honor of Strom's birthday, why don't we name this lake after him? And he gets Bob Dole, John Warner, Alan Simpson, Robert Byrd, big coincidence, Sam Nunn, and Alphonse D'Amato to form this bipartisan committee to name a lake after Strom Thurmond for his 85th birthday. This is all, where do I get the moment of clarity? The Congressional Record. They get somebody in the House to introduce the legislation, and in 2 weeks, now how often does Congress get anything done in 2 weeks? In 2 weeks, right in time for his birthday, they get the lake renamed. One little problem. The people living there didn't like it one little bit, okay? It had previously been called Clark Hill Lake, after Clark, the guy who gave the land for the lake, okay? So there was actually some meaning to the local people, but they didn't know Clark or remember Clark anymore, but they did call it Clark Lake for generations, and they weren't too happy about this. So they got one of their congresspeople to introduce a bill to undo this and call it Clark Hill Lake again, and he struggled for a while, and this actually hit the New York Times, and there were articles going, but we thought he was really popular. We don't understand this. And the people said, it's not against Strom necessarily. It's just that we don't like you unilaterally coming in and renaming our lake. This has meaning for us as Clark's Hill Lake. But in fact, there were other people saying, doesn't he have enough stuff named for him? This is just, you know, kind of a very bizarre use of the democratic process. Okay, some other controversies that have come up around naming that you might be familiar with societally involve a very different set of considerations, and those have to do with folks like Martin Luther King or Cesar Chavez. There's a comedian named Chris Rock that has as part of his routine this kind of joke about how if you go into a new city and the street's called Martin Luther King Boulevard or Cesar Chavez Boulevard, don't go there because it's going to be all poor people and scary and dangerous. He says it funny. You get your humor where you find it, I guess. But there's some interesting trademark questions here, too, which is if you are indeed, as a community, naming your poorest, most desperate streets after Martin Luther King or Cesar Chavez, is that really an honor? Are we honoring these people if that's what we're in fact doing?
And then you think about it a little more, and you think, well, if you took the ritziest, you know, most upscale street and named it after Martin Luther King, and it turned out to be mostly rich white people, that's kind of strange. There's something disconnected about that because of who the people were and what they stood for, although in one sense, I guess, a sort of upscale sense, that would be more of an honor. What happens when communities do try to name these upscale streets after Martin Luther King or Cesar Chavez is that it turns out, unfortunately, that the residents rebel and oppose this, and they have successfully in many communities. And you say, well, if people object to having their street names, I just said a minute ago people didn't like having their lake named after, renamed after Thurman, that kind of bugged them, and you really need to pay attention to that, that maybe if people live on the street and are invested in their address, we should also be concerned if they don't want the name changed. But then another part of me says, those people who are so desperate not to have their street named after Martin Luther King are the people who most desperately need to have their street renamed after Martin Luther King, because in a couple of generations, he will become normalized. He'll become the Francis Scott Key of their neighborhood, somebody that we all recognize as worthy of respect and worthy of having the street name. Okay, so this is all very complicated. Where I'm going in the paper, and I'm running out of time here, is I'm looking for a more democratic process, more transparent, that we name the physical public domain, especially when we're talking about physical public assets that people haven't purchased, because that's the university setting, slightly different. The streets in Columbia, South Carolina, this is a plaque that says they are all named from east to west for products important to the state's economy or for important South Carolinians. Do you see any way, well, you wouldn't know, but I'll tell you, one of these streets was named after a woman. Anyone want to guess which one? It was not Blossom, that's for Cotton Blossom. Lady, it was named for some lady. I do not make this up. Taylor was a person, Hampton was a person, Washington was a person, Lady was like some anonymous lady, Gervais was a person. Very few women make it into the physical public domain. Street names particularly are part of our personal identity, and in a sense, they are compelled speech, right? You have to give your street name for your address, and that becomes part of who you are, where you live, and I would argue that we have to really think long and hard about how we're naming this and why certain people never get sort of written into the physical public domain. The effects of naming, visibility, endorsement, validation, reward for service, all these things would, I think, pertain just as equally to many women, but they do not because of the way the political process works. Now, here's the comedic portion of our presentation. There are streets that few people want to live on. Drink and Drive, Pothole Place, Curds and Whey, Angry Disenfranchised Londoners with NRA Memberships Boulevard, Coronary Bypass, Superfund Lane, Lost Kitty Mews, Vicious Circle, People's Court, or West 196-841st Street. These would all be examples of names we don't want. The reason I kind of bring this up is because even though there are infinite possibilities for naming streets, with only really a few names that we all like, Maple Street, Elm Street, whatever, you can think about the same phenomenon with first names, right? There are infinite possibilities for first names with how many people are named Jennifer or Ann or Dan or Mike, right? There are names that we gravitate to, and we don't tend to be creative in things like that. What are the best practices? This is what I'm still struggling with, but I think at least we need some sort of standards and procedures. We could just award it to the highest bidder, but of course that just means all rich people. If we're going to have some sort of direct democracy involved, what's that going to look like? Again, sort of going back to my some streets you don't want to live on, I mean, you really have to take people's views into consideration at some level, but how you do that, I think, is going to be fairly complicated. Should we have a formalized regulation of naming? I don't know. I do know that if we did, I would take some issue with like the Robert E. Lee high schools that populate the South. I swim at the Maxie Gregg Pool. He was the first lawyer to lead a contingent in the Civil War. Guess how he did? He lasted about 20 minutes in his first fight, but now he has a pool name for him. And I will make fun of myself. The first Civil War general killed was Francis Stebbin Bartow. He died without offspring, so I am not a linear descendant. I am not, as far as I know, related. But it's actually having the name Bartow gave me unexpected and alarming currency in the South when I moved there. But there is a difference. I mean, think about it. We have Robert E. Lee high schools all over the South. There are no Adolf Hitler high schools in Germany. Why the disparity? I mean, I guess at least part of the answer might be Robert Lee wasn't quite as evil as Hitler, but it's very strange the way we enshrine Lee as opposed to the way some other cultures
kind of deal with these issues. Well, I've used up my time, and I didn't quite get everywhere I wanted, but I did want to follow up with one thing, which is that Sanford Levinson, who teaches law at Texas, wrote a really good book called Written in Stone, and it's about the monuments in the South, and his thesis is that we just really need to think deliberatively about who we sort of honor as heroes in monuments and also overlapping street names and building names and things like that. And I read that book, and I thought it was pretty good, and I thought he said a lot of things that were interesting, and then he has these weird references to Catherine MacKinnon. So I just want to kind of close with this, which is I'm still struggling with. He talks about the fact that Jefferson Davis got a stamp. And he's kind of concluding, and he says, I personally have no wish whatsoever to honor, in however limited a way, Jefferson Davis, any more than Catherine MacKinnon would easily acquiesce in a decision to place Hugh Hefner on a stamp. This obviously has nothing to do at all with the significance of these men. I presume that MacKinnon would readily agree that Hefner, with his Playboy philosophy and magazine, is one of the true shapers of contemporary American culture, just as any objective historian would concede Davis's impact on American life in his own time. Scholars certainly should try to understand both men, and no one could cogently object to their being the subjects of probing biographies. If casual importance is enough to merit a stamp, though, one would expect to see Al Capone or Lee Harvey Oswald grazing our nation's letters. But it is surely obvious that such casual significance is not enough to merit public homage. Even the relatively limited homage that comes from being placed on a stamp to commemorate is to take a stand, declare the reality of heroes worthy of emulation, or less frequently than an event that occurred at a particular place was indeed so terrible that it must be remembered forever as a cautionary note. I like everything he had to say, but I couldn't help notice that throughout the book it had never really troubled him at all, and almost all the monuments he was talking about were for men. And when I read this paragraph, I thought, because he's completely marginalized the woman's issue. That's Kitty MacKinnon's issue, right? Her issue is with Hugh Hefner. I'm talking about serious stuff like racism. Now, I like the book a lot, but like women didn't seem to have any place at all in his consideration, so I guess, you know, that's one of the things I'm going to talk about.
So these are such great papers because, like all real first order scholarship, they make you think differently about things that you have repeatedly experienced and taken for granted and naturalized in some way. And that's certainly the case for me. I spend a fair amount of time these days driving between Washington, D.C. and its precincts of men in marble and the eastern shore of Virginia. And so you leave the district where every second white stone object is named after Ronald Reagan, and you move out into the countryside, and the land gets flat, and after a while, if you look very carefully and quickly at the roadside, you'll discover that for a brief period of time between Easton and Cambridge, Maryland, you're actually traveling on the Harriet Tubman Memorial Highway, which is near, in fact, to the birthplace of Harriet Tubman. And I'd never thought about that before. I'd never thought about Ronald Reagan and Harriet Tubman and naming. And so as I was reading Ann's paper, I began to think about it, and I thought I would do a Google search. And I did Ronald Reagan, Harriet Tubman Highway. And something really interesting came up, which is this piece of legislation. It's Wisconsin Assembly Bill 559 from 2005. And it directs the Wisconsin Department of Transportation to designate and upon receipt of sufficient contributions from interested party, mark the route of U.S. Highway 14 in this state from the Wisconsin-Illinois border to Madison as the Ronald Reagan Highway in recognition and appreciation of the public career of Ronald Reagan, who served with distinction for two terms as 40th president and who subsequently demonstrated grace and dignity in his struggle with Alzheimer's disease. The bill also directs the Department of Transportation to designate and upon receipt of sufficient contributions, etc., mark the entire route in the state of State Highway 122, that's the entire route now, as the Harriet Tubman Memorial Highway in recognition and appreciation of the life of Harriet Tubman and a leader of the movement to abolish slavery in the 19th century, who led over 300 slaves to freedom in the North on the Underground Railroad, etc. So I thought, this is really great. You know, this is the progressive tradition of Wisconsin. Here they felt that they were under some pressure, like everyone else, to name something for Ronald Reagan, but he just got a little part of this highway. Whereas Harriet Tubman, who was the counterweight in this act of naming, got a whole highway. So at least it's a fair deal, and maybe better. And then I decided to look a little further. And I found a wonderful website, which I recommend to you, called Wisconsin Highways, www.wisconsinhighways.org, which gives you the down and dirty on the highways and byways of the state of Wisconsin. Well, I'm sorry to tell you that it turns out that even though Ronald Reagan only got part of Highway 14, Highway 14 is a really, really important highway. In fact, so important that another part of it in a different state is actually named after Laura Ingalls Wilder, which is another piece of the story. This is a highway that runs for 200 miles across the Midwest. It's one of the original arterials of the U.S. highway system. Of course, from the Illinois border, it runs directly into the state capital of Madison, and all that part though it be, belongs to Ronald Reagan. Well, it turns out that Highway 122, that's the Harriet Tubman Memorial Highway for you, is a bit of a different proposition. Highway 122 is 21 3/34 miles long, and it is a... No, I'm sorry, that was Highway 120. I've got to get 122. It's only 14.69 miles long. And it is one of the so-called four unanswered state trunk line connections, which were originally going to be connected into a single road along the Michigan coastline, but somehow it never actually happened. So basically, this is a road, a 15-mile road, that goes from nowhere to nowhere in Wisconsin. And so the appearance of neutrality that was so initially attractive about this Assembly Bill 559 begins to dissolve when you look beneath the surface. And that's what's so great about all of these papers. They deal with practices and institutions that we might initially expect or assume to have neutral character, and by examining, probing, and uncovering, they reveal in very different ways the absence of neutrality, especially, but not only, gender neutrality that these different practices and different discourses, in fact, contain. And they do that, as I suggested earlier, through dealing in the vocabulary of embodiment. I think it's a general shortcoming of a lot of legal scholarship that we don't talk enough about bodies, that we make an earnest and within the framework of the discourse, I suppose, successful attempt to distinguish always between the corporeal and the doctrinal. Think about criminal law, which is all about bodily restraint and display and the infliction of pains and punishment on bodies. And we manage to talk about criminal law almost all of the time in terms of the most rarefied and abstracted notions of right, and ignore to our peril, one might say, but ignore nonetheless the corporeal dimension. A lot of other dimensions and branches of scholarship have done a lot better with bodies than we have, including, of course, the scholarship of feminism. And one of the things that's great about all of these papers is that they are part of an effort to bring various notions of embodiment into the domain of legal scholarship. So Anne's paper invites us to see how the social and legal process of naming, embodying, human reputation in the built landscape encourages, in fact, the marginalization of women's contributions and those of other subaltern groups. And in the process, and this seemed to me to be a particularly interesting and important piece of the paper, contributes to the literal rewriting and remaking of history. Eileen's paper provides us with a gendered account of access to medicines, a dilemma that we're always thinking about very much in terms of North-South conflicts, but which of course exists within our society as well. And she talks very persuasively about how the outcomes of our IP system are sometimes literally written on the human body. She demonstrates that those outcomes may have dramatically disparate effects on different groups, as here, where the very aspects of over-patenting that she summarizes in her account of the several breast cancer treatments that she reviews is to reduce women's ability to receive needed treatment for the disease. In fact, Eileen points out, the operation of the IP system has blunted the effectiveness of initiatives to achieve more scientific focus on and more governmental support for breast cancer treatment. And Rebecca's paper reminds us, as she pointed out in her introduction, of the disruptive and disturbing effect that the intrusion of the body may have on legal doctrine itself. Through its demonstration of the ways in which public representation of the female body, often though not always in unflattering ways, is privileged in transformation analysis, fair use, as well as by exploring the way in which the other aspect of fair use analysis, the market analysis, consistently elevates the significance of stereotypically male modes of economic participation over stereotypically female ones. She reminds us, and I think it's a critical reminder, how admirable and even useful aspects of intellectual property doctrine, like fair use, may be built on foundations of disembodied discrimination. So I started with another voice, and I want to end with another voice as well, this time not the voice of the Wisconsin State Assembly, but the voice of Jeff Koons, talking through an affidavit in the litigation between himself, on the one hand, and a photographer named Andrea Blanche, on the other, about the issue of transformativeness. Andrea Blanche had taken a fashion photograph which Koons had assimilated through repainting as part of a larger composition entitled Niagara. And here's what Jeff Koons said. He said, when I saw the article in Allure magazine about cosmetics, certain physical features of the legs of the model represented for me a particular type of woman frequently presented in advertising. In this photograph, I saw legs and especially elongated toes that were glossy, smooth, expertly manicured, and dressed in very expensive and not particularly practical sandals. For Niagara, the painting, I removed these anonymous legs from the context of the photograph and totally inverted their orientation. I then added these legs to other contrasting images of legs, and along with ice cream, donuts, and pastries, floated them playfully and ethereally above a liberating landscape of grass, a waterfall, and sky. In so doing, I transformed the meaning of those legs, as they appeared in the photograph, into the overall message and meaning of my painting. I thus suggest how commercial images like these intersect in our consumer culture and simultaneously promote appetites like sex and confine other desires like playfulness. This photograph is typical of a certain style of mass communication. Images almost identical to it can be found in almost any glossy magazine as well as in other media. To me, the legs depicted in the photograph are a fact in the world something everyone experiences constantly. They are not anyone's legs in particular. Now, it's interesting because although Kunz is speaking to the claim of transformative use of the photograph, he seems to find it necessary, nevertheless, to talk about the alienation of the depicted body part from the model for the photograph. And this is, I think, another example, maybe a useful one, maybe not, of the kind of rich confusion that Rebecca's paper reveals. So I've got questions for you guys, but maybe first I wanted to ask you whether you've got things you want to ask each other, and then maybe we can hear from the audience, and time permitting, I'll ask a few things too. You got any?
Well, the only thing I kept thinking at the end of your presentation, Anne, was have you done those things where you, the memes where they say, what's your porn name? Right? And as it turns out, it's supposed to be the name of your pet and the name of the street that you grew
yes,
up on.
Yes, I had forgotten about
so,
that.
So you might look at that because people do identify with those in very powerful ways.
Yeah.
But other than that, I want to hear from other people.
I had a question for Rebecca, actually. I was wondering kind of the inverse of the scenario you talk about in terms of explaining where a fair use claim works or doesn't work. I don't know if this is hard to maybe suss out, but are there any cases where copyright infringement is sort of unduly asserted because the nature of the copyright infringement sort of comes back and adversely impacts the image of the work, or that has a gendered bias, so that the plaintiff's claim is either rooted in misogyny or shame or some kind of transformation that's really not?
Well, I think it happens a lot that a lot of the offense that people feel is that like Mattel feels like Barbie isn't that way, right? She you can read that either as Mattel trying to control sort of its own special ideal of the sort of passive female body, but that's nonetheless valued positively. So I don't know that you can say it's simply misogynistic or simply feminist. I mean, certainly the people who attack Barbie define themselves as enacting sort of feminist critiques. It's just so happens that those are the feminist critiques that always require displaying her really openly. And in part, that's because you can't critique Barbie by making her run for president. She's already run for president, right? So, and I'm not really sure what to do with that other than to say that, I'd like to think about finding a space for the non-sexual reclamation of her image.
Questions?
Josh?
And it raises some more questions about the relationship of IP law to other law in general, and rather than it being maybe a feminist critique, maybe it's more of a Marxist critique. And the question in regard to, and it's really mostly coming from Eileen's paper, but I think it's relevant to the others, biogenerics don't have a process for new drug approvals, for equivalency. And the question then is for the rights that are granted, what do you do when they end and you're supposed to have market access? And the answer is there are lots of things we could do, such as compelled production, price regulation, all sorts of things that we don't talk about. But particularly in regard to direct price regulation, there's a bad precedent developing. I don't know if you're aware of the D.C. pharma law decision where, at least for states that were trying to regulate price on pharmaceuticals, they said that federal patent law preempts any state price regulation on the theory that Hatch-Waxman itself reflected a carefully balanced decision about the amount of reward that pharmaceuticals were able to recover, which seems to me both a terrible extension and a mistaken understanding of Hatch-Waxman. But the main point is very simple. We have to find some way of thinking about when the IP rights or even the non-IP but regulatory structure creates natural monopolies, and what do we do with them, and are there other ways that either feminist theory, Marxist theory, or something else can get us to get off our duffs and start doing things that are socially beneficial that require things like interference in the market?
Right. Well, I don't know that I could offer something from feminist theory so much as just feminist advocacy, which is sort of what I'm flagging here with the case of Herceptin, which is the first, really one of the real blockbuster drugs coming out of biotech medicine. And you're right, we have no way to guarantee that in due course, upon patent expiration, we're going to see a generic market develop. But what I do think that the women's health movement and the breast cancer advocacy, and what I didn't flag enough in my talk, were the instances where women's groups have really weighed in on IP issues. For example, women's groups were involved in asserting their rights to be part of the class action lawsuits involving Taxol, certainly tamoxifen. The National Coalition of Breast Cancer Groups commented on the utility guidelines in the patent office vis-a-vis gene patenting. But what I think is going to happen, and it's interesting because Herceptin is illustrating also the kind of advocacy that I think will travel from Europe over here because of government-provided health care. Herceptin is actually such a great drug that it's not only now recommended for late-stage breast cancer, but early-stage breast cancer, which will only increase, obviously, the number of patients who want to get it. And I think what will happen is sort of the feminist version of what's happened with the AIDS drugs marketplace and the way regulatory mechanisms have somewhat adjusted, fast-track approvals and the way that regulatory processes did yield upon significant advocacy. One thing I'll just mention, which is sort of interesting about Herceptin, I didn't mention it in my talk, there's only a subset of women with breast cancer who can benefit from Herceptin. And when you're diagnosed with breast cancer, you can get yourself tested. You can get your tumor tested to see if it's a candidate and will benefit from the administration of Herceptin. So this is also going to be a real test case for, what's sometimes called pharmacogenetics, pharmacogenomics, personalized medicine. Here you're basically told that genetically, you're in the hot spot for benefiting from the drug. But, is it true that you necessarily, as a component of being told that, really get access to that drug? I think I would offer up more just the model of the sustained advocacy that I think has led to the increase in breast cancer research funding that we saw through the mid-90s, translating. And the reason I wanted to do this paper is to show that here and there, and also for the paper, to kind of help the cause of recognizing where IP issues where they do either create a bottleneck or they certainly create a parallel track of concern, that it's more than just, banging on the door of a drug company, or it's more than just saying, I want my health insurance company or Medicare or Medicaid to cover something. Are patent issues actually in the way of why something is costing as much as we? So it's more than just asking for somebody to pay for it, please, but why is it even costing so much? And, do we really have bona fide reasons for not having a competitive pharmaceutical marketplace with certain drugs? Or when you peel behind the curtain, is there a lot of these patent gaming strategies that really account for delays that really shouldn't occur?
I have a question for all of you about sort of the animating parts of feminist theory that are coming through in your different papers. And as I heard them anyway, and I'll give you this as a way for you to respond off of them to see if they came across to me the way you intended them. I heard in Rebecca's paper her offhand comment about Catherine MacKinnon really coming out of dominance theory and trying to think about how dominance theory plays out in a very particular area of IP law and what effect it has and what insights it can give you. In Anne's paper, I heard going back to the public-private distinction, that there is this public world that even when it's privatized, women don't inhabit. But there's something about the public-private distinction that is operating there, that women's public visibility almost doesn't exist, and in Peter's gloss at the end, exists only from one place, a highway that goes from no place to no place. And then in Aline's paper, what I heard was from the women's health movement's concern historically for the invisibility of women, that in something that promotes science is neutral, medicine is neutral, and from the very beginnings of the women's health movement, one of the animating principles is beneath this neutrality is a deeply gendered reality about how these neutral principles play themselves out in mm-hmm. practice. So I hear three very different and related strands of feminist theory, and so I would like to hear maybe each of you talk a little bit about what was animating you in this IP gender connection.
Sure. It actually wasn't an offhand reference to MacKinnon at all. That is, I consider my feminism to be very strongly influenced by Catherine MacKinnon by way of John Stuart Mill. I think it's not often appreciated that MacKinnon is, in one sense, the direct intellectual descendant of Mill in her emphasis on what it is that we don't know about what women are like, given the construction that we always already face, that sort of radical undecidability of what women's culture would look like. So that's something I think about a lot, and certainly she's influenced my thinking. And one of the really interesting things to me in your comments was you used the word visibility in talking about Anne and Eileen's presentations, whereas mine is actually is about visibility in a very different way. It's just that when women are visible in the public sphere, they turn out to be naked, right? And that takes over, right? The only way that that women get to be in public is then we look at their appearance, right? So why would we put their names on a building? Because that's not, that's not how a woman is in public in the standard narrative. So I guess that actually goes to you.
Yeah, well, I actually consider myself to be talking a little bit about dominance theory, too. The gender part I'm really struggling with for different reasons. I mean, I think it's definitely in there, but trying to draw attention to the fact, I mean, really it's all about power and privilege. And as I see it, men just marking their territory, right? I mean, literally marking their territory for themselves on their own behalf. Now, every once in a while, just recently there was a news blip, Mitch McConnell's wife, Elaine Chao, he's like rigged it so that some building at the University of Louisville is going to get named after her. So it's like convenient. You're married to a senator, whatever. Then you can kind of exercise your dominion. And she's, somewhat famous in her own behalf, so I guess they could justify it. There's the business school at the University of South Carolina got a $40 million gift from a woman named Darla Moore, and they named it the Darla Moore School of Business. And then there was this revolt that it was too girly, and they had to drop the Darla and just, I'm not kidding, the Moore School of Business, that there were like girl germs all over the business school. So I don't know that that's like some linear feminist theory, but I know there's a lot of gender stuff going on, so I guess I am. That's where I am.
I'm not sure I'm gonna make a claim, with this, with these various scenarios, that there's a disparate impact upon women's health of IP. Without, running a parallel study on, for example, prostate cancer treatments and, asking what happens there and if, some generic marketplace opens up. I'm really not making that claim. But in terms of the invisibility of women, I mean, you're certainly right. What part of what you, and it does answer your question about what animated me in the project. One thing I was concerned about, and I saw it from my own years in practice, was, you know, as you have more attention on women's health issues and get more work, more research, more science, and that's great, and that's arguably what we'd like, and, you know, gender parity, you know, needs us to be at least as healthy and as availably healthy as men. You know, is that in a parallel track accompanied by the kind of IP conflict and disputes that paradoxically, and I think I say this in my abstract, frustrate access? And will we see IP strategies that become very sophisticated and are particularly the result of very lucrative and very well-developed markets because, you know, that it's great that it's on the radar screen, but look what it invites because it is on the radar screen. And you're right in terms of women being invisible, in terms of women knocking on the doors of medicine and science. It wasn't only let us in as professionals, let us in as patients, study us, you know, make sure that you even understand women's health, you know, before you even think about what can address women's medical problems. I mean, women had to get in as patients, let alone as professionals.
Let's see. The mic is coming.
Hi. I had one of the things that I think I wanted to sort of trace out with each of your papers, because I think we're at this distinct moment where we could do a more intersectional approach, and not, I think one of the things I learned the most from feminist theory is that we can't just do gender. So with all of your papers, I was seeing this sort of trace of more racialized constructions, constructions of heteronormativity. In terms of Rebecca's paper with trademark and the Barbie example, I think it's a wonderful place to sort of explore how trademark preserves dominant ideologies of heteronormativity and racialized constructions, and how are these counter-hegemonic uses of Barbie, and I guess I'd like to see sort of like how that is being preserved through trademark, and I think the Barbie example could be used in terms of teasing it out, and I'm wondering if you've thought more about that. And then also the naming, I'd be curious to see what we see in the trend of naming with Rosa Parks, with this sort of onslaught of now we're going to name things after Rosa Parks, things have already been named, and sort of tracing like what's the distinction between the naming process with her name. And then in terms of the patent drugs and how, you know, how patent influences not just the access to breast cancer but also the affordability of the testing, I think there's a really ripe space for conducting a racialized and class dimension of that too. So, I mean, I think we're at such a unique position to start like automatically doing an intersectional approach from the very beginning. So, and I saw this going on in all your papers and just wanted to see if you've thought about that, if you've been able to tease that out.
Hey, why don't we let Eileen start this time?
Oh, no, you're certainly right. I mean, particularly in terms of talking about racial disparities vis-a-vis women and breast cancer, I mean, they're really quite striking. And the access of, you know, there's just a recent study out in terms of the access of the African American women to adjuvant therapies, which is a lot of what I was talking about, which isn't really surgery, radiation, but all the drugs that they'll offer you once you're diagnosed with breast cancer. You know, very obviously, not obviously, unfortunately, reduced access. And so the disease really, you know, taking a toll that it shouldn't need to take in the African American community. But any time, I mean, in a broader sense, you know, when you have a monopoly structure, which a patent at least will allow the holder to create, you know, an extreme monopoly position as opposed to perhaps a more, I mean, the patent holder can set up a more competitive marketplace. It's in the discretion of the patent holder. When you have a monopoly structure, and I guess Herceptin's a good example currently of this, where, you know, in any of these biotech drugs, it's very concerning because you've got Herceptin, Avastin. I mean, there have been a number of articles just in the last few weeks in the New York Times about the very high price now of these new cancer drugs. And one thing that I'm very worried about is that, of course, this is the great promise of genomic medicine to develop, you know, to really target the specific cancer cell and go right at it and leave the rest of the body undisturbed. But, you know, are these kinds of treatments, you know, then going to be priced at such a level? And as I said earlier, you're really seeing the pressure now in the UK and Australia from women who want access to these treatments, and they're, I mean, a lot of third-party payers in the USFR will pay for this, but, you know, that's because the market's been limited to late-stage breast cancer patients. As early-stage breast cancer patients have the option to get get these, wow, that's going to really create some significant demand, I think, to address the pricing problem.
One of the things that's, you know, that I wrestle with a little bit with your Rosa Parks question is simply that there's no process where everyone, with the outcome, everyone's happy with the outcome, right? Just recognizing that. I mean, there's still, South Carolina took a long time to recognize a Martin Luther King holiday, and there are still people that think we shouldn't have it, and you ask them, and they'll kind of hem and haw, and they'll say, well, you know, it's nothing against him, it's just that there are other people more deserving of recognition. So, you just can't wrap your mind. I mean, there's just no way everyone's going to be happy. So I'm just more process fixed that if we could have a process where the people who, for whatever reason, don't want to honor Rosa Parks could feel like at least they could have input into the next street or something, and that it wasn't just one group dominating, then maybe that's my best outcome.
I sort of stayed away from the Barbie trademark cases because I wanted to do copyright fair use in terms of your specific question. I mean, one of the things that had pointed out to me at AALS a little while ago was how many of these foundational cases also involve African-American artists, right? And, of course, there is this tradition of appropriating African-American artists' work in ways that are historically not compensated at all, much less considered as possible infringements that would then justify a fair use defense. You see a little of that in sampling, but what's very interesting about that is those tend to be not always but often within race disputes, and then sometimes they're not, and I'm not sure that there's a consistent pattern one way or the other. It certainly is the case that I'd never be surprised to see a racial issue come up, in part because race makes people nervous, and what makes us nervous is what we experience as transgressive, right? And that's also why you might see some mixing of sex and race. So Pretty Woman, for example. I wonder what your implicit image of the woman in Roy Orbison's song is, and whether she's the same race as your implicit image of the woman in the Two Live Crew version. I suspect that she's not. Or again, in The Wind Done Gone, again and again, there's this discussion of miscegenation and homosexuality, right? Mixing, or I guess failure to mix with homosexuality. So those culturally those are tied together, and I'm not sure I know how to separate them out or in any useful way yet.
I have questions for Rebecca and Eileen. Sorry, I loved your talk.
I just answered it all for you.
So, two things for Rebecca. I wanted to, number one, suggest, and maybe this is in the paper, which I read really fast, but you could strengthen your argument even more if you, number one, talked about like the Google Perfect 10 case, which treated a pornographer as in the market. And if you talked about some of the idea expression cases, so I don't know if you saw the Southern District of New York just handed down a case, and I think it was Jimmy Choo, but it was some shoe. Susan, do you remember this? So the photograph was of, it was an ad photo to sell shoes, and the model was in the stall of a bathroom, and all you could see was her feet and like panties stretched between her ankles and a designer handbag on the floor next to the feet, and then the company told the photographer, or the ad agency told the photographer, we don't want this photograph, but then they hired someone else to do ad photos of women in restroom stalls with the panties stretched between their feet and the stiletto heels, and the court, it was an idea expression case, right? And but it's a similar thing. It's like the transgressive, it's sent a fair to have that sort of imagery, and it just made me wonder whether you would find more stuff like that, which you probably would, I bet. I'm willing to bet money on that. Eileen, I wanted to push you I really loved hearing about all these different drugs, but it strikes me that if I wanted to look for a common theme that would unite all the three papers on the panel, it would be one that would characterize your paper in a way that you probably don't intend, and it's this. So Rebecca's and Anne's papers are about different ways in which women are in public, and so women in public are lady, right? And as lady, they are sexualized. Why is it that when we want to talk about patents and women's health, what is the canonical example is breasts? And so if we're going to interrogate publicly the connection between patents and health, it will be around this issue of breasts rather than, you know, the vaccine that they're developing now for HPV or the cervical cancer treatment or any of these other biotech things or heart disease and its differential impact on women. So you've told this story of advocacy groups coalescing around this particular issue. And there are people who you probably know this are very critical of how much visibility the Susan Komen Breast Cancer Foundation gets for its walks and its 10Ks and its whatever, as opposed to these other women's health issues. You said, you know, I don't really have a theoretical frame to put on this, but that's a theoretical frame that you could put on this, but then I don't know if that's one you want to, that's one that you want to have.
I'm definitely aware of the criticism that breast cancer has eclipsed the leading killers of women, which are heart disease, and certainly lung cancer kills more women. But breast cancer is interesting to me because it certainly is the leading gender-specific killer of women. I mean, it's certainly the leading medical problem for women that's gender-specific. And it also, and the reason, I mean, that's part of the reason I chose it. The other reason I chose it is that it seemed to me it lent itself to something a question I started with initially, which is, could you sort of project how the IP climate would develop over time as you really looked at sort of the arc of a research field, as you looked at the older style approaches to cancer, this could be a set of any cancer, and move then into genomic medicine, you know, how do the IP conflicts shift over time? Could you learn something from the kind of patent conflicts that attended the sort of older cancer or chemotherapy drugs and try to head off some of those same problems as you moved into the age of genetic medicine and breast cancer? And then, of course, you've got the angle of gene patenting and DNA patenting and the particular patent conflicts over that, which not every women's health disease has that. So, I mean, breast cancer just sort of lines up with that question for me very nicely and also with a kind of intellectual trajectory of the field that also then has its own parallel IP trajectory that goes along with it.
Could I just interject something? I'm sorry. One of the things that's interested me, because I've been thinking about it, is the reason breast cancer, I don't know if this is interesting to you or anyone except me, but is also more highlighted is the HPV implicates sex, right? I mean, you only catch that by having sex, whereas breast cancer can kind of be an innocent, do you know what I mean, sort of have that whole pink sisterhood, whatever. I mean, there's just so many different things going on socially with that. I just think that's part of the answer, that HPV, you know, you have to think about sex because that's how it gets transmitted.
I just want to say one last thing historically, too. Since breast cancer activism was partly in response to the AIDS Community Act, organizing largely the gay male community organizing around AIDS, I think there was some sense in the feminist health communities, gee, what are women doing about their health when men are organizing around an issue at the time, which was seen to be largely an issue of gay men, certainly late 80s, early 90s. So there's a little bit of that kind of gender reaction that sort of crystallized that. But I do agree that I think there's a sexualized reason why breast cancer research, you know, has a certain prominence. And, I mean, I don't know if anybody watches news coverage of breast cancer, but, I mean, they can't resist doing a shot of mammography, you know, to illustrate almost anything dealing with women's health, which really is the point that you're making there. I mean, in terms of, you know, we can't ignore the sexualized aspect of breast cancer and some of the cachet that may attend to it as a result of that.
So I actually wanted to say I love the idea about looking at the idea expression cases, which I have not done, but I shall do. The thing that strikes me about the Google Perfect 10 example is there you have you have the marketplace for sex and the marketplace for everything else breaking down, right? Google will sell you anything or will show you anything. And in fact, that's sort of the promise of the pornographer, right? I'll sell you anything. Anything you want, anything you can imagine, things you can't. I will produce it and sell it to you. And that's why maybe the pornographer has had the most success in defeating this argument on the fourth factor that, you know, there are some markets that people won't enter. Well, obviously there are, right? And for too long, fair use has gotten away with claiming that empirical reality neatly matches the normative claim that, you know, there's that people won't enter this market, therefore they're not being harmed when we let somebody parody them in that market. Well, that's just not true anymore, right? So we're going to have to decide, do we care about the empirical claim, like there is money on the table, or do we care about the fact that you just shouldn't be entitled to that money, right? That's just the rule. And, you know, we pretended that you didn't have to choose, and now you do, and I think the pornography is actually, it's not at all surprising that it's coming to us from sexual material, people who are willing to license their sexual stuff.
I have short questions for Anne and for Rebecca, and I haven't seen the paper, so I apologize if you've covered these. Anne, you talked a little bit about the way in which the naming of streets causes certain associations,
right,
that people take from that because you're forced to give your street name when you give your address, you perhaps aligning yourself with certain associations, or you give certain associations to where you live because of the name. And I'm wondering if you're giving any thought to the attempt to impose those meanings on new development, right? So I think you're talking, I think, mostly about renaming streets, right? So
well, both, naming and renaming.
Right,
yeah.
But if you think about new development, there might be a way in which developers might try to sort of zone certain areas or impose certain cultural meanings on certain areas by giving a street a particular name. So to sort of decide whom they want to live there and then give the street name in order to promote that.
Well, I can't speak for every community, but I know in many communities the way at least residential development works typically is that the residential developer owns the land, builds the streets privately, names the streets privately, and that's why you get your Lisa Lane names after his kids, Lisa Lane and Michael Lane and all this kind of stuff. And then, because the people who move in don't want a private enclave, or they may not even be able to have one, they dedicate the streets to the town. So the developer actually builds them, but then the maintenance comes over to the town and it all becomes annexed by the town. So then it becomes, again, a renaming issue. You could get into the first cut, you try to coerce the developer, but then it's just a private actor. It's much more interesting to me, and I think you have more leverage when it becomes the public street, and then you at least have the opportunity to dialogue about, do we want, you know, to name the streets in a meaningful way, or should we go for the sort of least, you know, most innocuous Elm Street and Maple Street and Main Street and kind of things? If we're going to allow a Thurman Boulevard, do we then, you know, is there any obligation to at least open the floor for a Martin Luther King Boulevard or Rosa Parks Boulevard or some of the local South Carolinian heroes, sort of, you know, Harriet Tubman, whatever, something like that.
And Rebecca, one question for you. I guess I understood you to be saying that courts are making judgments about sort of which derivative markets are legitimate and which are not, as far as the fourth factor goes. So markets dealing with reinterpretations that involve gay themes, for example. I think you said that the courts are saying, well, no one would go, the copyright holder wouldn't want to go into that market, therefore it's not a fourth factor issue. And I wonder if there's a way to tell that story that in fact says, well, in fact, for certain, you know, what we would say, what the copyright holder might characterize as other or outlaw culture, in fact, because it doesn't bounce up against the fourth factor, ends up being more freeing, right? And there's more room to play and more freedom to create there. And so if there's a way, if that's true, is there a way to draw the line to say, well, in certain instances, we would want that to happen. We like the fact that, you know, quote-unquote outlaw culture has more freedom to create without also roping in the type of more objectionable freedom recreation that you're talking about.
I guess I'm not sure. Like I said, I don't think that these cases were the fair use cases where they found fair use were decided wrongly, right? Because I'm in favor of that sort of play and recoding anyway. It's just that a lot of the recodings, given the culture we live in, will tend to focus on sex in predictable ways. And the problem that I see is that courts aren't willing to see transformation elsewhere, and that, you know, they see sex as revealing something about the original, and they don't see violence or even, you know, commercialism or a critique of commercialism as revealing something around about the original. So, I guess I'm not sure that there is a line to be drawn, and I don't want to be in the position of saying I don't like a bunch of these uses, therefore I don't think it's fair use. Right? I'd rather have an answer that maybe speaks in a broader language to people who aren't necessarily going to agree with me about what's bad and what's good.
On which note, we should. We're at 3:30. For you, Christine.
I just wanted to tell Rebecca that my mind is just swimming. I mean, all these cases that you talk about are cases that I teach all the time, and I have, like, such new insights on these cases. It's fantastic. And it seems to me that there's a really obvious point here that never occurred to me, and I'm not sure it's so boldly stated in your paper, which is women's bodies are meant to be commented on, right? That, you know, if transformativeness is commenting on the original, if there's the mere presence of a woman's body in the original, it is fair game, and there will be fair use. And I think the case that so clearly expresses this, which is not really a visualization of a woman's body, is the Two Live Crew case, because there Roy Orbison is commenting on a woman's body, and, you know, that just opens it all up, and so Two Live Crew have a different comment. I think also your Dungeon Barbie case, there's not even a comment, and nor does one even need to be made, because there's just a woman's body there, and so, you know, to say if there's any speech at all, it's a comment, and comments are fair. Somebody ought to tell Mattel this, and then they'd stop suing everybody, because they've necessarily got a bad case, I think.
I think that's a great way of putting it, and the thing that's particularly interesting for me is to see at least some women doing that with men's bodies. And, you know, there's obviously a huge debate. You know, is that really what we want for feminism? I mean, I think it may be part of what we want for feminism, but maybe there's something else that we can aspire to together. And, you know, I don't know what role copyright has to play in that, but maybe it has some.
Great.
I gotta go.